Lanny is a novel that reads like a modern fable, and it's a story that echoes with English folklore. Now picture the title character. Lanny is a sprite of a boy and he's skipping merrily through the woods singing. He lives with his parents in an English village and it all sounds rather idyllic, doesn't it? But Dead Papa Toothwit, a shape-shifting wild spirit of the land, has been awakened by Lanny's song and we fear for this little boy. This book follows Max Porter's award-winning debut novel, Grief is a Thing with Feathers. He joins me from the BBC Bristol studios. Welcome, Max.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I believe this story began as a poem many, many years ago.
Yeah, I'd be a bit uneasy calling it a poem. It was a kind of
what was it then?
Series of thoughts written down in a poetic fashion, yeah. I mean, I'm not a poet, but yeah, it was a sort of long prose poem, yeah. And I put it in the drawer because I wasn't at that point a writer. I was someone that just fiddled around with stuff and filled my notebooks with stuff.
And how did it come out of
the
drawer?
The key ideas were there. Well, it came out of the drawer because suddenly I'd had this book published and it had done well enough that I could give up my day job. And my agent was saying, are you going to write a second novel? And I said, no. And then I sort of thought, oh, actually, I'm desperate to. You know, having said I wouldn't do it for the sake of it, I realised that actually I wanted to do it for the joy of it. Mm. And then I thought, do I want to write a book about England now? And I thought, definitely not. You know, what's going on in England now? And then I thought, no, definitely yes, because maybe I have some things to say about England now and the relationship between England now and England's past and the way it thinks of itself and the stories it tells about itself. So I got this poem out of the drawer. And actually, I was pleasantly surprised, you know, because actually some of the best stuff you ever do is the stuff you abandon. So I thought, yeah, there's something here. And actually it was more like translating it from poem into novel.
And what was it that you saw in that poem that you thought could be resurrected?
The main thing, you've read the final novel, so you'll know how important this is to the book, is the relationship between Pete and Lanny, the old man, the artist, the kind of outsider in the village, and the boy who is himself an outsider in a different sense. And in that relationship, I loved that when I wrote it 15 years ago, and I love it now. I invest a lot emotionally in the possibility of a relationship like that between an old man and a young boy, free from the suspicions of society. And looking back, I wrote that poem around about the time of Operation Yew Tree, you know, when all the kind of old male celebrities were being exposed as child abusers. But the possibility of a relationship which is pedagogical, you know, it's a teaching relationship, it's an educational relationship, but it's not at school. It's free from all the strictures of education. There's no grading, you know. Pete teaches Lanny to love art, to look at the world differently. And I guess for me there's this like an element of escapism in that relationship, because it's not the kind of relationship that the world lets you have at the moment. So that's where it started, and that seemed to me a beautiful, organic possibility, a philosophical possibility, you know, a thing that I could posit as being possible and then build a novel around it, i.e. how do other people look at that relationship? How would, if I kind of got you as the reader complicit in that relationship and then suddenly took the floor out from under your feet and said, is that relationship okay? How do you feel about trust between a young boy and an old man? And all those kind of things.
Mm. So where did this character, Dead Papa Toothwit, come into the picture in this story between the younger boy and the older man? So Dead Papa Toothwit is this spirit of the land, a shapeshifter, a trickster, somewhat ominous. How did this character come about?
Well, he's the Grief is the Thing with Feathers me that realises that the kind of novel I want to write has these characters in them. Maybe not forever, but for now at least. I have to have this mythological force in the books that can say things about human nature that realistic, you know, socially realistic characters can't. And part of that is having fun with language. I need someone that can kind of roll language around on their tongue and be a more experimental force in the book. But the other thing is that I wanted this dark fairy tale texture to underpin the whole thing, because I think if you juxtapose modern life, you know, the anxieties of late capitalism or living in the Anthropocene or any of those things, if you juxtapose them with this kind of deep time mythic force, then you shed a really interesting light on the stories we tell each other now, for example about innocence and friendship and education and stuff. But the simple answer is that I just love to write those characters, same as the crow in my first book. I just have a lot of fun. It's the easiest thing to write for me, the ones who love the language like that.
So the crow is this life life-size figure who accompanies the father and the two boys who are grieving for the mother.
Yeah, and he's simultaneously a kind of poetic device, but he's also a joke, and he's also, crucially, both Dead Papa Toothwort in my new book and Crow in my first book are both aware of what they are as literary devices. They're armed with self-knowledge, so they can poke fun at themselves. That's crucially important for me, because I don't want these devices to be kind of postmodern tongue-in-cheek. You know when an author does something and they kind of think they've been really clever and you realise that actually that's just a kind of display of their cleverness for the cleverness's sake? I want these characters to be much more on the reader's side, much more collaborative effort with the reader to sort of point out what they're doing. So that's what these characters are doing. But also Dead Papa Toothwort allows me to write as truthfully as I possibly can about the great sweep of English history, the way that we have always been lied to by the ruling elite, the way that we have always, you know, richer have always got richer, poor have always got, you know, he's like a mad radio, you know, he's got like a radio mic stuck to his face, you know, like those people that give bus stop tours of London, you know what I mean? But he's had a few too many sherries before he went off on the tour.
But crucially, he's of nature, and we think of England and we think of the vast tracts of nature that Robin Hood was having fun in. Those are gone. Yeah. So he's evoking an old world. And a world in which we were at one time one with nature. But he isn't a very comfortable force either.
No, the major break he's recognizing, because he says, you know, I've seen civil war, I've seen witches drowned on this land, I've seen enclosure, I've seen men beat each other senseless, etc., etc. But the major change that he is documenting and is evidence of, and one of the reasons him and Lanny are so attracted to each other, is the poisoning of the land, is the eco catastrophe facing us all. And for him, that's the major event. He's not interested in Brexit. He's not interested in the triggering of Article 50. But what he is saying is, you don't have much time left to reassess and properly address your relationship between human beings and the planet, and think as outside of the human consciousness. Stop thinking about, you know, trees with the voice of humans. Think of them as trees. And so he's a kind of both him and Lanny are slightly pagan in their outlook. And the English tradition has that, but much of it is spiced. Actually, Australian literature and poetry perhaps has a better relationship to it because of your indigenous writings and the wisdom of that tradition. But in the UK, much of it is unfortunately flavoured with a kind of romanticism which borders on the kind of fanatical, almost like eco-fascism, do you know what I mean? Like this kind of blood and soil worship of the land and England for English people, and much of it's absolute nonsense. So what Dead Papa Toothwort is suggesting is his kind of philosophy as regards that nature and man would be that no one has owned this land, no one is from here, no man can call this home authentically, it's immigrants all the way down, and any attempt to label it and own it and cut it up is part of human folly. And obviously, who understands that best? The child. Children always understand that best.
Lanny is a real contrast to this ominous figure of Dead Papa Toothwort, because he's this sprite of a boy, but he is a real contrast to Dead Papa Toothwort. But we only ever see Lanny through the eyes of others, his mother, father, family friend Pete, and neighbours. Why do you want us only to see him through others' eyes?
Because I think that readers of novels do more interesting work when you let them do it themselves. Same as how it's disappointing when a character is shown on the cover of a book, illustrated on the cover of a book. That means you don't have the freedom to imagine that character for yourself. And that bothered me as a child, you know, when I saw like a picture of Robin Hood on the cover of the book, and he was like incredibly handsome with a really beautifully coiffured beard. I'd be like, oh no, that's not my Robin. You have to work against that illustration. So what I want the reader to do is imagine their own Lanny, and it worked. The book is like a mirror, really, and it has worked. You know, some readers find him incredibly pretentious, fey, you know, other readers really are drawn to him. They find he has a kind of magnetic presence, and that's the work I wanted to happen. It's not for me to say what this child is like. It's for the reader to do that work. And so obviously the idea of Lanny is so different in his father's head than in his mother's head, such is life, I think. And one of the things the novel should be trying to do is recreate the conditions of consciousness whereby you I mean, in this book, for example, you judge people, and then later on in the book, you feel a bit guilty because you've judged them prematurely, or you have a hunch about someone's character based on the snippets of information you've been given or overheard about them, and then later you feel this affirmation you were right about that person, the judgments you made about them, and that's how life works, how society works, and I wanted to kind of recreate those conditions in a collaborative way between text and reader, so that I'm not saying to you, this is a bad man, this is a suspicious woman, this is a hypocrite. I want you to have those thoughts, and later on for those thoughts to be held up, you know, bathed in the light of the events of the book, for you to consider them afresh.
Mm. Now, a child goes missing, which is, I guess, a well-trodden trope in fiction and, in fact, in our daily nightly news. But how do you make this old story in the form of the missing child new again? Is this your attempt at that, or is it not really about that missing child in the end?
It is about that. It's about how that story plays out in a community. And what I hope is that the village acts as a kind of model for, you know, so that a marriage is any marriage, or the village is any village, and any village becomes any city and any town, any country and any nation state, because the mechanisms are the same, the way in which assumptions become solidified, in which like tiny little flickers of bigotry or aggression grow and become kind of weaponized. What I hope is the missing child narrative itself, what happens in part two of the book is I remove everybody's names. You don't know who is speaking. So some people think of the missing child as an incredibly exciting opportunity to be on the news. Some people think of it as the judgment of God. Some people think of it as absolutely the work of a wicked man who is a predatorial character and steals children. And I want all these different narrative opportunities to swirl around the place as they do in life. I think, as you say, because it's such well-trodden material, I don't actually need to recreate it. Mm. We've all read books about missing children. We've all seen crime dramas about missing children. Same as, it's a trope. So what this book does is doesn't give you any of the details. It just moves to the responses. It keys in on the most, I think, the most interesting responses in private. So in the privacy of one's own home at night when you're going to sleep, what is it you say to your wife about that missing child? And what is it your wife says back when she says, God, you think that? Or have you really been having those thoughts? Or be more honest about the thoughts you're actually having. I want to get to that. I find that more interesting than the thing itself, which, as you say, we've read a million times.
Yeah, but you do render it so in such a new way, and you're sort of touching on something ineffable, really.
I hope so, but that's what Deb Papatoothwort is listening to. You know, he's a voyeur, and what he as I said, he can give or take Brexit and the next Brexit and whatever Brexit, the next, you know, these bastards will hoist on us next time, you know. But what he's particularly interested in is what we say to each other in private, how we actually feel, and the ways in which we come to terms with what we're most frightened of or fail to, you know, and those things coexist, and it's the coexistence of those things and the gulf between those things that gives society the tension that holds it together, or indeed, as we're witnessing in this country now, breaks it apart. And I'm interested in that in the same way as all novelists are. Like we're very nosy people. We're voyeur. We're people watchers, and it's not
like
necessarily
you don't necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And he's not necessarily interested in the main narrative. He's interested in the kind of tapestry of narratives that support or undermine the main narrative.
So is it possible to write a contemporary novel in England at the moment that doesn't evoke Brexit?
Yeah, I hope so. And I think the ones that would be most pertinent to Brexit are the ones that don't mention the B word. You know, same way as, you know, Jane Austen's novels were written during the Napoleonic War, but they're never about it. But they do show you English society in an extraordinary way, which historians would find immensely valuable to shed light on the political backdrop to those wars. I think if you write directly about something, you firstly date the material, and you secondly inevitably show your own hand politically, and I'm not particularly interested in doing that, although it wouldn't be difficult for a reader of my novels to know where I stand on things like immigration, because I don't hide that stuff. But I don't think you want to be documenting contemporary politics, particularly when things are moving so fast. So I hope that Lanny is a book that makes as much sense in whatever crises we're in 10 years' time as it does in this particular crisis.
Max Porter, your first novel, Grief is a Thing with Feathers, was adapted to the stage. Did that experience influence your approach to writing Lanny? Because of those multiple voices that we hear, particularly in that second part of the story.
It did. I was finishing Lanny, or I don't know, was I finishing it? I was certainly writing it when I was working with Ender Walsh and Killian on the play. And the main thing was, the voices, certainly, but mainly it was a kind of stripping away of everything that didn't need to be there. Like, when I didn't know much about the theatre, and what struck me most on day one was the unbelievable power of a single voice looking the audience in the eye with no special effects and no mannerisms. You know, like, the novel is full of mannerisms, you know, beginning, middle and end, and this character's backstory and exposition, you know, how do I get character A into this building? And I just thought, God, I don't need any of that. I can just look the reader right in the eye and say, bang, mythological character, wide awake, obviously very much in love with this child. You know, make of that what you will, but this is what's happening, and we're only on page two. rather than kind of suffocating the thing with explanation and exposition. So it taught me that. It also made me think about the excitement of such things as just suddenly changing the scenery. So I started to think about the characters in my book as two-dimensional things to be slid on and off. Mm-hmm. And what happens if I just, like, you've read the book, so you know what happens in part three, which is obviously very indebted to the theatrical world. Like, what happens if I just suddenly say, nope, that we're all watching a different show now, and it's a show that relates to the show you've been watching, but you need to completely suspend your disbelief and be in this show, otherwise you're going to miss what's happening. And
we somewhat enter the dream world.
Yeah, and the membrane between the so-called real world and the dream world is not thick. It's not impermeable as the modern realist novel has told us it is. And in that, I suppose I'm as indebted to children's books as I am to the theatre. But, you know, why not suddenly drop down a different backdrop? Or why not suddenly have your characters attached to strings, you know, so they can suddenly lift off? And I don't think you need to be showy about that if it's true to the work, if it's the work's heart trying to get through, rather than the writer's cleverness, as I said at the beginning. Like, I'm not doing that to impress the reader. I'm doing that to further the emotional atmosphere of the book and the truth of the characters and the dilemmas I've set up. I want it to be, the freedom one feels when looking at the theatre, like the enchantment. I want to re-enchant the novel, and I don't necessarily think that needs magic.
It's
the same kind of thing. Yeah, rewilding, re-enchanting, re-energizing, just kind of accepting that the kind of urbane, cynical, ironic atmosphere of the novel is no longer appropriate. One of my early, really, I got a really nasty review early on, and it said, "Beware mystical thinking." And I, over the months, I've been thinking, actually, we could really desperately do with some mystical thinking. That might be exactly what's missing from the current climate.
Well, Max Porter, thanks very much for introducing me to Lanny and, of course, to Dead Papa Toothwort.
Oh, thanks for reading it.
Lanny is published by Faber and Faber and was longlisted for this year's Booker Prize. The novel is also set to be made into a film produced by and starring Rachel Weisz, so I'll be really interested to see how The Ineffable is translated to the screen. If you like books that push the form, like Max Porter does with Lanny, you might be interested in an Australian debut that has a very experimental approach to the novel. Find out all about Alex Landrigan's novel Crossings in the latest of our debut writers series. It's a seriously interesting conversation you don't want to miss, which means you'll just have to sign up to our podcast to catch it.